This is Sass What. I'm your host. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined once again by my pal, Sean Forker, or you may know him as the Fork Chop, which is one of my favorite nicknames for anyone ever.
And you can go to my website, theforkchop.net. Support it.
Thumbs there you go. Sean is, if you haven't listened to the last episode, I highly suggest everyone go back, listen to the last episode. You're going to get a wealth of knowledge about the Bigfoot community and Sean's place in it. And I didn't say this in the last episode, I probably should. There is a debt of gratitude that I owe him for my interest in the subject, because if I had not listened to the Sasquatch experience, I list Sean right up there with like the NAWAC and Brian Brown and the Bigfoot Show as one of the reasons I got into Bigfoot to begin with. So it's your fault, Sean.
Well, I'm proud of that. I always said if it happens, don't name it after, but let's do it. I'm proud of that. Anytime we can get somebody hooked on something that is as great as Bigfoot research, I'm proud of that.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I'm doing the show. I wanted this to be more of a introduction to the subject for newbies, and I think this episode will be especially exciting for newbies, because what I want to talk about are sightings and stories and get into that stuff, because that is the part of this subject that people love. They love the scary stories. So, and someone that's been in this as long as you have, I know you have a wealth of knowledge about this stuff. So now, before we get into other people's stories, do you have one of your own? Do you have a sighting? Do you have, what's your favorite encounter story that you took part in?
I kind of have two, but one happened and they happened like 6 years apart from one another, which is pretty interesting because I have a thing for even numbers and it just happened to work out that way. But in 06, I was on an expedition with the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Society in Keystone State Forest. And I was out there with a gentleman who's been in the field for a long time. His name is Tim Cassidy. He's not, you know, a well-known name, but he's somebody that I hold in high esteem because he's been pretty faithful with his research. And he and I, we had just finished a day hike, and it was him, myself, and another member of our party. We were walking back to the vehicles, and the other person and I use their name because I haven't talked to him about using their name, so we'll call him the other person. She and I were walking up to get back to the vehicles, and Tim had stayed behind, and he had yelled, "Hey, Sean, come back here and take a look at this." So I run about. He's about 50 feet behind me to catch up, to see what he's doing, and I don't see him on the road, and he's off the road down in this little gully off the side of the road. And I go to step in, he goes, "Watch." And I look down, and, you know, there was some, you know, something had definitely been walking through this path, and there were these large foot impressions in it. I think it was like 15 inches long, like 7.5 inches wide. It's been a long time, and I don't have notes. And so, you know, we just start following them, and there were just tons of them that we followed up until this point where it came to this little plateau. And the weather started getting rough, so we had to head back, but we had marked the spot to come back. I'd marked it with Tootsie Roll wrappers, and it's important for a reason. We felt odd about this place when we were at. We had come back, the weather did get a little rough. We came back with more members a little later and went back to this plateau, and it looked like we had really pissed something off, because, like, there were a lot of, like, tree limbs broken. And in fact, the only reason we knew we were in the same area was because of the Tootsie Rolls I had marked it with. Well, that could have been wind or whatnot. I don't put a whole lot of credence in what caused the damage, but there was damage done nonetheless. So we're going through this little plateau area, and this little nest-like structure. That looks strange because, well, it shouldn't be there. It didn't look normal, and it just kind of looked out of place. So Tim starts poking around in it, and, you know, we hear this crash in the brush, so we go to follow it. And Tim's hit with this overwhelming sense of euphoria. And, you know, all of a sudden he just gets hit with, like, this whatever. And I get hit with this overwhelming sense of fear and nausea. And I, like, literally start getting ready to puke. And Tim and I are just like, what's going on here? And there was this huge crash in the brush. It sounded like a freaking bulldozer was just plowing right through the woods. And fight or flight kicked in. And I chased after it. And at the point people realized I was chasing after something, they're yelling at me to stop, and there's about 10 other guys with guns, you know, following me, yelling at me to stop, because I don't know what I'm chasing. And of course, at that point, you don't know in your mind, you know, I just wanted to see what the heck it was. I was young and stupid, and we never did see what it was. But that sense of what we felt was just so odd, and I've never felt that before, ever. And as we get back out to the clearing, the power line clearing, to walk back to where we parked the cars, a member of the party said they saw a human-like shaped figure standing at the other side of the forest line watching us. So I don't know if that was what I followed. It was really interesting, that experience I had. Or I felt that way, really kind of shook me up. I remember calling my wife crying that night because I was like, I don't know what it was. I just don't want to be out here anymore. I want to come home. I didn't. I stayed the course. But that night we had gone up to the Chestnut Ridge, which is one of the most, you know, active areas of Pennsylvania for Bigfoot. And I just wouldn't even leave the road. I just stayed out there and kind of just watched everybody else do their thing because I was kind of shaken up by it. It was my first real experience with something. I didn't even see it. You know, later on, after I talked to other people and we'd done interviews about it, you know, the thought of infrasound had come up. Maybe I was hit by infrasound. And the symptoms are very, you know, relative to what other folks have experienced and what you would experience if you were hit by infrasound.
Yeah. Describe real quick what infrasound is for
infrasound,
and
for those you who aren't listening, is a form of communication used by large animals to communicate over long distance. It has a better permeation. It's not as obstructed, you know, obstructed by trees, and it just kind of does its thing and gets to where it needs to get. Elephants use it. Apparently tigers use it to stun their prey. And it's thought that the Bigfoot creatures use this as a way to get away and not be detected, or just to use it for its own practical purposes, maybe stun their prey.
Mm-hmm.
But the government has experimented in infrasonic weapons and used it as a non-lethal form of crowd control. So it is a real thing. Just whether these creatures use it or not is yet to be determined. But in order for these creatures to communicate over large distances, it makes sense that they would use something like infrasound to communicate.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it does have the side effect of making people nauseous, uncomfortable, and can drive you out of your skin if you're exposed to it long enough. So we thought perhaps maybe that's something we experienced. And the fact that, you know, Tim experienced something very different, you know, he always kind of relates it to a, you know, maybe we experienced something more hormonal, like, you know, or pheromonal released. I don't know. I'm no biologist. All I know is it freaked me out. It was one of the more scary things in my life that happened until the end of September of 2012. We were camping out in Clearfield. And we had done some previous work out in Clearfield and had some activity going on in this area. It's a meadow. It's off the beaten trail. You can see it on a map, but I'm not going to tell anybody where it's at because it is an active, ongoing research area. It's just private. Now, I'm not a snob. I'm just not going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take you there, but I won't tell you. And we had set up camp. We're out there with members of the PA Bigfoot Society, and it was a quiet night, and Dustin and I, one of my research partners, he and I were building our fire, and we had sat it up, and we're sitting there, and it's just getting right to be at dusk, and it's just starting to turn dark, and I saw something through the smoke kind of walk through our campsite quickly and into the woods. I'm like, I did a double take. I'm like, what the hell did I just see? And I looked at Dustin, and Dustin's looking right at me, and he looks at me and goes, did you see that? I said, yeah, I saw it. So we run to the edge of the woods, and we're trying to look in, and we can't see anything because it has gotten dark in the forest at that point. And it was like a tall, lankyish, not lanky, like a nerd lanky, but lean figure that walked through our campsite. And it was really kind of like a tannish color. We didn't see any kind of facial features or anything for it, but saw this figure. I'm like, wow, that was interesting. So we're still, you know, kind of doing our thing. We're sitting around for the night, and we'd pack up, put our fire out, go in the bed, and about 45 minutes after we're in the tent, we started hearing footfalls around our campsite. We're listening. We're like, okay, well, it's not deer. Whatever it is, it's got a bipedal motion on it. Is that a person out here playing around with us? And we keep listening. And, you know, I look down at the edge, and the orange on the where the campfire was, it's the campfire is glowing again. Well, we had moved the logs a good 5-6 feet away from the fire. So whatever had started the fire had moved the logs back on, and, you know, this coals had to have stirred up. I'm like, well, this is really freaking me out. So Dustin gets dressed and gets out, and he puts his, you know, puts his shoes on and gets out and starts looking around. And I get my shoes on and get ready to step out, and he goes, Forker, grab me my gun. He always keeps a gun with him for safety. I get him his gun, and as I step out, he goes, well, look, off to the side of our campsite, that same figure we saw earlier ran up the hill. So at this point, I'm just, like, freaked out. Because, you know, I was talking to John Kirk about this, and if folks don't know who John Kirk is, he's been a man involved in cryptozoology for a very long time. And, you know, the funny thing we talk about is, you know, even though we're out there trying to prove that this creature exists, when you have an experience of your own, why the hell aren't you ever prepared for it? And I don't think anybody could get used to the shock and awe as having experienced something like that. And the rest of the night, you know, I had got so shaken up, I had called a member of the PBS to come back to extract us from that area because I wasn't walking to my vehicle by myself. And I didn't feel comfortable with just a couple of us doing it. And they had come back down and spent some time with us. They're like, yeah, maybe you ought to stay here for the rest of the night. So we did. And lying there, about a couple hours later, same thing. Here comes the footfalls again. I'm like, whatever this is messing with us. So we get out of the tent again, you know. If anybody's out there, you know, you need to come talk to us because you're putting yourself in great jeopardy. Nothing did, you know, happen to show itself again. Go back in and lay down. Footfalls again. This is getting old all night. And then finally daybreak started to hit and it started to rain. And I knew at that point nothing was going to bother us anymore. So we quick packed everything up and I ran the 2.5 miles out of there to get back to my car. And I'm not a small guy. I ran, dragging a tote full of our belongings with us, and got the heck out of there because it had startled me so bad to the point I told Eric Altman I was done. I wasn't doing this anymore. I was finished. I didn't want to experience that. And I'm not doing it a lot of, you know, probably giving it a lot of, you know, pop and circumstance that it deserves. It really bothered
me. Well, you got to think, I mean, you're back probably pretty far. I mean, obviously 2 miles from your car. Not only that, but yeah. And what kind of person, you got to understand, like, to be in Pennsylvania back in the woods and be messing with someone, you'd have to be a mental deficient.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially in Pennsylvania. You know, we're known for our guns out
there.
And I'm not a gun. I'm not a gun guy. I carry a machete. You know, that's just, I don't trust myself with guns because I'm skittish. And Dustin was in the National Guard. You know, he did some service for us as a country, and I appreciate that. And he keeps his piece on him for safety. At least one of us does, because you don't know if you are going to experience something like a bear or another predator out there, and you should have something to scare it off or protect yourself, you know. Or in the backwoods of Pennsylvania, you don't know if you're going to run into somebody from the hills have eyes. It's a scary place. And this area is in a hotbed of Bigfoot activity. I kind of kicked myself in the butt for being such a pansy when all this was going on, but I don't think I ever expected something like that to happen because I never had a sighting before that. Mm-hmm. And that was my first sighting. And the thing I struggled with after that is I always thought people that had sightings and got into Bigfoot were doing themselves a great disservice because they lost some objectivity. They wouldn't be able to keep it. And like everything was going to be Bigfoot related. And I guess maybe I was wrong with that because for me it's maybe more skeptical because, you know, having experienced something that we don't know what it was, I'll say that for a fact, it could have been anything. Mm-hmm. I think I know what it was, and I'm kind of finally comfortable with that. But it kind of shakes you to your principle, you know, the core of your principles. And, you know, you have to be a lot more skeptical, I think, and not just of yourself, but of everything you take in, because you don't want to be bought into it. You know, you don't, because, you know, there are Bigfoot believers. They call themselves the knowers. And then there are people that are actually interested in this for scientific purposes to prove it exists. And seeing is not always believing. Because I think some people see things and need medication, and some people see things and, you know, maybe make it out to be more than it actually is because that's what they want it to be. That's the uncomfortable part of it for me, is I saw something, but did I see it because I wanted to see it, or did I see it because that's what I think it is? And, you know, I question myself constantly over and over and over until the point where I'm finally comfortable thinking I know what I saw, but, you know, I'm my own worst critic, I guess, because I still overanalyze it. And I'm very critical when people come to me with their Bigfoot sightings. One of the biggest things I have a problem with is objectivity when you're an investigator, you know, and you're actually, you know, interviewing a witness. You know, how much more damage are we doing, and how much disservice are we doing to ourselves if we're leading these people and telling them what they saw, and they're telling us what we want to hear? And that's where, I guess, my research technique has always been different, because I've always just let them talk. And if I've had questions, I've asked questions. But I always do it in more of a respectful, skeptical kind of way, you know. But it's always been more like, well, tell me, describe to me what you observed, you know, without telling them, well, what color was the Bigfoot that you seen? And you know, you and I laugh at that because we're rational people. But there are people that when they're out there investigating, so tell us how tall the Bigfoot was. And, did you give the Bigfoot apples? And did it come on, knock on your door and ask for garlic? You know, those kind of things. And we do ourselves as a community, and we use that term a lot, community, because we are some weird dysfunctional community with so many different outlets. It's hard to keep track, you know, with the paranormal and the you know, and the habituation people and the telepathic people. And, you know, it's so hard to kind of keep it straight, and we wonder why science doesn't take us so seriously. You know, someone's got to be the voice that stands out of the many voices, and I hope it, for God's sake, that somebody that's more eloquent than I am and a little bit more science, has a more of a science background, because I don't want these telepathic Bigfoot people speaking for me, and I don't think it's going to do us anything, any justice to the scientific aspect of what we're doing. And if I'm wrong, I'll admit, hey, telepathic people, if Bigfoot communicates and we can prove it telepathically, I'm sorry in advance. I was wrong. That's just where it's at. It's just not something I think is happening.
So, outside of your own personal experiences, state of Pennsylvania has a lot of sighting reports, and I know that from my little bit of research just into newspaper articles, especially there in that Chestnut Ridge area. That's one of the conversations you and I were having on Messenger, and I said that I'd been finding articles going back to like the 1800s, just like here in Ohio.
Oh, yeah. But
this is all based in one area there. So, do you have anything off the top of your head that you think of whenever you think of PA Bigfoot, that's like a great PA Bigfoot story?
Well, just because we talked about the Chestnut Ridge, the first night I went up to the Chestnut Ridge, we had happened to be stopped by some people that lived on the ridge, and they asked what we were doing out that way, because, you know, we were in their home turf, and we felt maybe we did need to explain what we were doing. And the people out there are like, oh, yeah. He goes, we've got all kinds of Bigfoot out here. He goes, we hear them every night. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, you got to be freaking kidding me. You nuts? And he goes, no, we can hear them, you know, scream, you know, at least a couple times a week. And to me, that was really interesting. These people were so comfortable with these things being there, they didn't even bat an eye to tell us about it. And if you, you know the history of the Chestnut Ridge, as somebody that was fresh new, that was really exciting for me to hear. Like, man, I'm here. I'm in the mecca of Bigfoot research in Pennsylvania, the area, the hot spot. And that was really cool. Sam Sherry, who, if you go to the Keystone Bigfoot website, keystonebigfoot.com, one of the pages I have is the legacy of PA research, and there I pay tribute to some of the people that paved the path before us, because I really think it's important that we recognize them for having the balls and the courage to, you know, look into these things when it wasn't cool and it wasn't hip, and people really challenged you and thought you were nuts. But Sam Sherry did a lot of research out in the Chestnut Ridge, and Bob France, who's not on there, where they've had some interesting sightings. But I, you know, in the area, one of the more, you know, the neatest reports that stand out to me is from a lady who was out jogging during the day. And there's an area called Gray Station, which is an active railroad, and it has a ton of reports. And it's in the Chestnut Ridge area. And this lady was out jogging and saw a Bigfoot carrying a dead deer over its shoulder, walking alongside the train tracks. And I thought that was one of the coolest sightings I have heard from that area. And there are a lot more. But it's just because, again, I say to you, because that area is so heavily researched, people get those sightings. I have a better sighting that was up from the northwestern part of the state, and from a lady. Her husband is a retired school teacher, and she's a retired nurse, I believe. And it's been a while since I've talked to them. They live in a remote area of Pennsylvania in the Cook's Forest. And she had a sighting at about 2 o'clock one morning. It had just rained, and she had come outside, and she had let her dog out to go tinkle. And she went out to the deck, and the dog stopped and started raising a commotion and ran back to her. And about 50 yards from her back porch, if that, there was she saw a Bigfoot creature going through the little garbage dumpster of hers that she had. And they just stood there looking at each other for about 30 seconds. And then it just walked away from her. Didn't show any aggression or anything. It just kind of walked away from her. You know, she's a 60-some-year-old woman. It frightened her to death. But just listening to her recount her experience and the other things that have happened to her along her life, that, you know, where she's lived in this area, was really awesome. And, you know, people like that, you know, often, you know, even by my own family, my mom's side of the family, which was never really into this, they like to yank my chain a little bit about it. But because my dad's side of the family is where all the weirdos are at. That's where I come from, I guess, mostly. And, you know, what makes you think Bigfoot's real? My pap's been a hunter, you know, all his life. And, you know, this last road trip he and I took, he had to talk to me a little bit about it. But he's never put a lot of faith and credence into it. I've been hunting for 40 years and I've never seen anything and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, that's okay, pap. You might not have. But the stories I hear from people that have been hunting for 30, 35, 40 years that see something one day that they can't explain and shakes them to the core enough that they can't go back to these areas, that means something to me. And those are the people I research for, so I can get their stories and you know, maybe help them through a little bit of a hard time that they're having. Because it to experience something like that are, you know, is shattering and, you know, kind of puts you in unfamiliar territory. If you've been out there in the woods for 35, 40 years, maybe longer, and you see something you can't explain that doesn't belong there, that's going to make you think. And it's going to make you question, did I just see something? Am I going mental? And it's uncomfortable for a lot of those people that do experience that. It's like Bigfoot research is kind of, you know, part biologist, part psychiatrist, part police officer. And you've got to do an awful lot of work in doing this type of field work and this type of study. It's you wear a lot of different hats. But the people that you do it for, the people that have these sightings, you got to make sure you're doing them a good justice and you have a level head on your shoulders so you're not messing them up more or supplanting information that really isn't there. You got to be sound in what you're doing.
Sean Forker, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Sass What. You can find Sean on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle? At Sean Forker. And you can find Sean all over the internet. Go to his website, which is theforkchop.net. Is that right?
Theforkchop.net.
Okay. All right. And that does it. We'll be back next week with another episode.